This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey Geekscapists, welcome to a brand new Geekscape podcast. I'm Jonathan London, your host, and each week I like to sit down with storytellers from the medias of, let's say, movies, video games, comic books, TV. Sometimes I sit down with musicians. I had some musicians on the show last week, if you guys want to go back through the feed and check that out. And that's what we do. We just talk pop culture. I like to find out why they tell the stories they tell. Usually they're talking about their most latest story, which is a double, I don't know if that's a double positive. It's not a double positive. That's just a really weird sentence. But we're geeks here, so awkwardness is to be expected. If this is your first Geekscape, that's it. If this is not your first Geekscape, welcome back, and thank you so much. I just smushed two sentences together. Welcome back. Thank you so much for joining us again. And you know what? We're having a lot of fun. Our podcast is now over at Pinecast. That's where we're hosting right now. And Pinecast has been fantastic with us. I think all of our Geekscape podcasts are over there right now. Thank you, Matt Kelly, for putting that together. And if you know you're enjoying Geekscape, go out and tell your friends about it. And let's get those subscription numbers up across the Geekscape network, because we're still adding shows. We just added a wrestling show called Matt Mania last week, which I think you guys can all be excited about. Speaking of Matt Kelly and the things that he brings together, this episode, I'm sitting down next to Mr. Rob Kuttner. Did I pronounce your last name right?
It's close, but if you pronounce it correctly, then it'll summon the beast. So
he's serious. Well. Yeah. Do you put a Q?
No, you got it right.
Okay, got it.
I just want you to get
no,
to like.
But how many times do I have to say it again for the beast? I want the beast thing to happen. That sounds cool.
it's 300,000. It's like a really imaginary, really slow version of Beetlejuice, where just like they spend the whole movie just.
Oh, 300,000?
Yeah.
Oh, Beetlejuice.
Can you get other people to say the name too? Yeah, I mean, is it a collective?
Oh, outsourcing. Right. Yes.
You can
distribute it around the country.
The demon worship.
Right. You can outsource
it. So I met Rob this summer at Comic Con, where Rob was signing copies of his brand new graphic novel. It's called Shriekage, and he was signing it at the Geekscape booth. And I think I was kind of running around like a chicken with his head cut off, so I didn't get to talk to Rob that much. But he's here on the Geekscape podcast. We talked about having him on the show, and miraculously, we happened to get it together right before LA Comic Con, which we're both going to be at.
Yeah.
And that is this weekend.
What were the odds?
In LA. I don't think the odds were actually that good, Rob. Like I think you're extremely busy. I continue my dance of running around like a chicken with its head cut off.
Right.
So I think the odds were not in our favor. But that being said, it was something that we were determined to have happen. It is something that we had talked about for
maybe
going back to like September.
Maybe the odds were not in our favor, but the destiny was there. The stars were.
That's talking about a whole different thing. And in Geekscape, if you think this is an arcane arts podcast, it might just become that. Speaking of demon summoning and destiny and things like that, I think this is stuff that all geeks end up falling into. So stick with us. So I met Rob, and here's the thing. I met Rob. It was like, hey, he's a writer on Conan. Mm-hmm. The Conan O'Brien show that is on TBS, which you have to correctively call Conan and not the Conan O'Brien show or the Late Show with Conan O'Brien or all the different... I mean, there were two or three iterations.
This is the third one, I guess.
This is the third one,
Late Night, and then this Night Show, and then Conan. So each one is getting shorter, I think. So same, it'll just be Co, or maybe K.
Maybe. But you've been on the show since NBC, or...?
Yes, I joined The Tonight Show.
The Tonight Show, that's right.
Yes, I was on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and I moved from New York to L.A. for The Conan Tonight Show because it's The Tonight Show. I mean, how could that be, what could go wrong there?
This is an institution.
What could possibly go wrong?
This is an institution.
Right, you don't mess with that.
All right. Yeah. NBC is not gonna do something crazy.
Some people, you could say I was a sleeper agent for Jay Leno, and I worked from the inside and brought it down.
No, Rob. I listened to Jay on Marc Maron recently. He was on, I think, over the summer, and I listened to that podcast very recently. And it's hard to think about that whole ordeal because obviously, like, I think you're a bit like me, and we grew up reading like The Night Shift and stuff like that. I think we were in high school, college by the time The Night Shift started coming around, and that was the book that detailed the going in and outs of like Jay Leno taking over The Tonight Show from Johnny and David Letterman going to CBS.
And the
wrongdoings or okay doings or back and forth dealings and all that.
The most important power shift in 20th century, you know, in the world probably, right? Like Yalta 2, they called it.
Well, for us, it was huge, right?
Right.
I mean, growing up, where did you grow up, Rob?
In Atlanta.
In Atlanta. So growing up in Atlanta, I'm guessing that the Turner stuff isn't like a point of pride. Maybe like you're working for
CBS
now. It's
such a coincidence. It's just a wild thing because Turner was kind of a backwater syndication network, kind of like until recently, like you're sort of like WGN. Like one of those things that just showed not very much original stuff, but like that was like the Flintstones, Honeymooners, Atlanta Braves channel, basically. It was like the one sort of cable channel I was aware of, I think, if you can call it that.
Right.
But now it's like this big force. So it's just weird that a show was sort of picked up and brought back to life after the Tonight Show thing by my home network, which is a completely different place.
But you were in the thick of it. You joined the Tonight Show thinking that this is going to be like, this is it. You know, this is an institution in late night television. Conan had long since proved himself. And then almost from the get-go, like, it's almost like wasn't given enough time to find its legs.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, you know, at this point, you know, time has enough passed that you can see that it just wasn't a good idea, or maybe it was not, like, the best fit of what Conan does to that kind of, like...
That hour, or what?
Yeah, that time, that sort of audience they were going for, which is very mainstream, down-the-middle sort of stuff, and that's just not what he does. But also, you know, they gave Jay Leno had bad ratings in the 90s, and they gave him, like, I think a year and a half or something like that, and then they jumped famously after the Hugh Grant...
I remember interview. That. I remember that weekend, that first week, that first night that he beat... Letterman. And you couldn't imagine that ever happening, but it took the Hugh Grant.
But it takes a while because like these things take a while for people to like get interested in something. I mean, people know about Conan, but I think like for the 11:30 audience to discover him and for him to get comfortable with that sort of stuff. You know, we had 7 months and then they sort of pulled the plug,
right?
Or let's say they made the ultimatum for midnight and Conan decided to pull the plug, but
so
it wasn't
a lot
of time to really find your footing.
So what is Rob Cutner thinking now? Now that he's gone from a cable show that had success like The Daily Show, still Jon Stewart at the time, right? And were you on the show with Craig Kilborn?
No.
Remember that?
I remember that.
I was like, damn. I enjoyed things on The Daily Show.
It actually drew me to it because, not because of him, but because the writing was so short. Like, it was kind of a weird backwater show in a way, too. Like, he was just this really attractive guy who seemed to be really dumb. But the writing around it, you could tell, was really smart and like kind of had a different point of view. And I was attracted to that when I was looking for a job.
And I liked him from SportsCenter. Like, I remember him on SportsCenter being like the guy who may not know what he's talking about, but he says something smart ass that is funny.
Right. He fits into a role very well, I think.
Yeah, so, and they had the one thing I remember the most about Craig Kilborn's Daily Show era, which for me was, I think it lasted longer than we give it credit for. I think that
it
Craig
was
Kilborn.
Like, yeah, it was like probably 6 years.
Six years. Because everybody only remembers, it seems like, Jon Stewart. But. Right. I remember they took that clip from Story of Ricky where the dude smashes a dude's head and they do the five questions and you just see like just the clip, the incredibly violent clip of a dude smashing another guy's head with his hands. And then it's, I think the Bush era is what turned that thing into a political show.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think Johns joined in 1999, and, you know, there were still, politics was not such a pressing concern for a lot of people, and then I think 2000 election, for sure.
Yeah.
The Bush v. Gore was, like, very, people started getting, that's when I think the Daily Show, before I was on it, really kind of fell into the absurdity of all the red and blue and the Chad County and stuff like that. And that's when they found their voice. And then I joined in 2002, and like at that point, Bush was in office, and John was just swinging at that point. I think what he was doing and had gotten political, and that was a good time to be on it.
Rob, did that draw you to the show, or like did you set out to do something political, like coming out of Dennis Miller and that?
You know,
whole
it is,
idea?
It's like, funny. I didn't really, you know, I didn't sort of enter the business. It seemed intending to be political. I was sort of always a political guy, but I was just always doing comedy separately, and I was trying a bunch of different things, and that's where the first opportunity presented itself, was in the late night world. Mm-hmm. I started off as a writer's assistant on Dennis Miller when my friend recommended me, and that ended up being political. And then I think just because I'd done that, I ended up starting as a writer there, and because I'd done that, and The Daily Show had an opening because they were losing someone to Kimmel, and my friend introduced me to people over there. I was like, oh, that seems like a good opportunity. As I said, this show is very well written, and it would be a good, cool place to try, you know, to try that out. So I think, you know, I think it sort of wasn't the overall general path, but once I got on that path, it seemed like a very cool thing to try, because as I said, it was not such a huge show back in the early 2000s. It was just something that I thought was really, really competently done, and more people should know about.
And The Daily Show's kind of become an institution, and then you have like the spinoff with Stephen Colbert, and, mm-hmm. and so, and now he is in charge of later.
I know. Stuff like
that. It's insane how
you respond everywhere.
Yeah, all the pieces seem to be shifting, and so you go to Conan, you're thinking, it's the Tonight Show, it's an institution. What were you thinking when suddenly they offered Jay like a 10 o'clock slot for an hour?
And well, the whole thing was weird. It was just like, I remember one day, like, the writer's assistant came in and said, you guys check out TMZ. And I was like, there's never a good reason that you're checking out TMZ.
No, yeah.
Like,
who got arrested?
Wow.
Who died?
Wow. Lindsay Lohan passed her driving test?
Yeah.
Sober? Wow, great. No surprise, a headline on TMZ. No, it's never good news. You're like, and why are we being specifically asked to do that? And all it was just that Jay Leno agrees to take 10 o'clock show. And at first I was like, well, that just seems weird. But then I started reading the analysis, and people were like, you know, it's not expected to do well. It's an unusual move. I remember Jay had given some interview where someone had said, if you're asked to come back to 11:30, because I think Conan's ratings were not doing well that time, at that point, would you do it? And, you know, so some people, the answer would be, no, I'm done.
We made
he's
an
like,
agreement.
And he's like, I don't know. I mean, that one of those noises he makes that are not legally binding answers of any sort.
Right.
At that point, we were sort of wondering what was going on with him. And then this was like the next step was like, why is he coming back to a show after he had this huge pomp and circumstance and retired and, you know, all the stuff he was going to do and said it on national TV, and now suddenly he's coming back. So it didn't feel good, but I don't think we necessarily knew what it was going to lead to, because all the negotiations were happening, like, you know, even we were not privy to them, like,
sure.
stuff. And then the next day, I think Conan wrote his editorial, and then we saw it when it came out in the New York
Times. And what was the editorial?
They called it the People of Earth one, where he announced that he was not going to take the midnight slot and he would rather do his own thing. It's sort of like...
Yeah, listen, like...
The FU to NBC.
It was... I mean, they announced that he was taking over The Tonight Show 4 years earlier.
Yes, I know.
Which is like, who does that? And last week, Geekscape, we had an episode with Yuri Lowenthal, who plays Spider-Man in the new PS4 game. Mm-hmm. And he had to sit on that for 3 years. So he gets cast as Spider-Man. He's incredibly ecstatic. Go back and listen to the conversation. And he then has to sit on the news that he's Spider-Man for 3 years until they make the announcement this past May at E3. 3 years, you know, and then the game comes out a few months later. So...
Listen, with great VO parts come great responsibility.
Yeah, with great VO parts come great responsibility.
Just like Uncle Ben.
Uncle Ben died to prove that point.
I wanted to give him a lesson about the show business.
And the thing is, like, it seems like that announcement is could have been twofold, where, you know, Jay's retirement and Conan's replacement of Jay would have happened, if it would have happened within even a year's time or a 6 months' time, it would have felt like a natural evolution. Instead, it was just weird.
Yeah, it was like anticlimactic after all this.
Completely anticlimactic.
Yeah. But I will say that being there during that, there's a 2 week, so there's basically that left 2 weeks left on the air of shows until
Conan was going to go off. I think because the Olympics were going to come on then, so there was going to be a natural break.
And then other networks recording the show. Well, I mean,
yes, yeah. Well, I was just going to say that like once we knew it was over, it was like this huge roller coaster ride because Conan just like didn't give any fucks at all, and it was like, can I say that?
Is this absolutely.
No,
yeah.
I don't want to shock your delicate audience.
No, you hear that, Frank Sanders in Long Island? He called you delicate.
So Conan was just willing to do anything. So that was really funny. Just had this devil may care attitude. And then he went out on the road and did that tour. That documentary, and then. And then he was negotiations with a bunch of different things. And it turns out I think it's just hard. Fox has always wanted a late night show, but they don't own their affiliate stations the way most networks do, or don't have the kind of connection where like the affiliates have their own shows they want to run. Like all the local Fox stations mm-hmm. have their own reruns they want to do. And they were like, we don't want to all agree on this. Like we all have our own agenda and stuff like that. So Fox couldn't get it off the air. Apparently FX was in the mix too.
And Fox had had its stab at late night.
They've tried before, but it's the same thing. It's like you have to sort of start with like a certain critical mass. I don't know how this works, but I think you have to have a critical mass of stations who are all going to show something at the same time so you can get some baseline numbers and see how it's doing. If they're all showing a show that's supposed to be like a scheduled show, like a late night show at different mm-hmm. times, or not even on the same night or something like that, I think it
hurts the cohesiveness.
The whole picture. Yeah,
of it,
exactly.
Yeah.
So he
goes on the road trip. While that's going on, was there a guarantee given to you guys?
No, we didn't know anything.
Holy crap. What's going through your head?
We were all kept in like little cells like Al-Qaeda and not allowed to talk to each other.
I mean, were there writers
basically unemployed, and Conan helped get us a nice like sort of severance package that was good for a little while. That was nice. But you know, we were all looking for other jobs, or you know, I had a baby and I was spending it. I mean, you know, not my own. I just had a baby that I found Craigslist. You know. My wife and I had a baby who just turned one, so I spent a lot of time with my kid and was writing, you know, pilots and working other stuff and trying to land other stuff. And then it was like 6 or 7 months later, the Writers Guild calls us and says, "You need to come in and meet with us so we can talk about your negotiation for the TBS show." I'm like, "What? Well, oh yeah, that's right. That's a TBS show. I remember vaguely, but." No one from the show told me.
That was the easiest job interview you ever had.
I was like, yeah, like okay.
But you had interest in it, of course, because you liked. I mean, how many of the guys carried over? People carried over, guys and gals carried over from NBC to the CBS.
Almost all of them. They had to cut it back a little bit because it was going from a network budget to a cable budget.
Sure.
But most of them, yeah, I was interested in going back. I'd just been there for only 7 months myself. I'd moved my family to be on this show and left another show I'd been on for years. And yes, I would want it to do more of it and also, you know, have a job and feed my baby.
So what's going through your head? Like that seems intense to me that you made that cross-country move for, you know, what seemed a pretty stable, sure thing. And then 7 months later, you look up and because your wife works in the industry as well.
Yeah.
And she must have had to uproot portions of her career as well.
Well, as you said, we had a baby then. So,
sure.
You know, that was also in the mix as well. I mean, you know, what are you going to do? Like, looking back on it now, it's like 9 years ago. So, you know, I can definitely handle the drama of it more than I can.
You were freaking out.
Yeah. that's a short answer. Yeah.
I'm trying to find the trauma, Rob.
Right, exactly. Find the trauma. That should be your next podcast title.
Find the trauma.
Jonathan finds the trauma.
Hey, why are you so fucked up?
Right. That's my opening question. Isn't that like the subtitle of WTF, actually?
What the fuck? Yeah, it's like, it might as well be.
Why are you so fucked up, and let's talk about my cats.
Yeah, I mean, listening to Jay, he took the whole, like, old workers approach of, like, hey, a job's a job, you know?
Right.
And someone offers you a job, you take it, you don't know,
right.
You know? It's like, oh, I don't know, it kind of sounds like, it sounds like loyalty amongst thieves kind of thing, where it's like, oh, come on, man.
Right, I mean, there's no rules for this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I think that he is someone who, like, a lot of famous people, you know, including Conan and other people, like when you're that famous, that's sort of like what you do, and it's really hard to not do it.
Sure.
I mean, look at, you know,
it's like, a gray
like
John area
Stewart.
As well.
John
it's
Stewart not, worked yeah. his, you know, worked his fingers to the bone in The Daily Show for 15 years, like way past I was there, and he was super involved with it, like heavily involved with it, and so much work. I mean, you saw his hair turn gray.
Yeah.
For that, and then when he was done, he was done, and they did a big send off, and now he's like doing stand up and stuff like that. So. When you're used to that kind of, I think you just get that high from the audience, and
sure.
you just sort of need some form of it. So,
sure, yeah, no, I imagine that retirement wasn't something that would have taken well to Jay.
And Jay didn't want to do it. I mean, he
right.
was sort of like you know, sort of talked into it and stuff like that. He doesn't ever want, he wants to do it until his, like, deathbed.
Yeah, the 4-year thing seems like.
Yeah, that was like a preparation for him.
He's like, hey, yeah, it was weird.
Yeah.
Everything about that was weird. So you start to write, so you were writing these pilots during that time, mm-hmm. and even though you're still writing for something like Conan, where you, I'm guessing you're getting fed in a huge way from everything that goes on in the world, and you're doing a bit of pull from the current events, you still have this drive to write narrative fiction.
Mm-hmm.
What was, when you're growing up, when you go to Princeton and you start writing there, I know you were writing for the Princeton, you were doing improv.
Yeah.
Which was probably some level
of
your fictional. Yeah, I do a little bit of looking around. Yeah, who's this guy? I can't have him signing on.
You had a PI following me for about 6 weeks. I thought that was a little extreme, too.
You know what? There's a price. Right. And I'll hear yours first, and I'll tell you mine. And if we meet somewhere in the middle, the secret steak.
We're going to describe a folded piece of paper being pushed across the table for you guys, and then you guys opening it.
Well, I did some research. I always do research whenever there's somebody that, like Matt Kelly. No offense, Matt. I love you. But whenever he, like, proposes something for the booth, and we got to fit him in, I'm like, oh yeah, let's see where this, like, let's make space for this. Because I'll tell you the truth, Rob, and this is the truth against here for all the Geekscapists, is sometimes we get, like, people at the booth and nobody comes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I'm like, well, let's make sure that, like, this person can, like, promote the appearance on social media. And let's make sure that, like, da-da-da.
You say before you do a favor, you would like something to be done for you, too.
That's not it at all, because I want to make sure that we...
Well, a win-win.
Well, I want to make sure that's not t-shirt sales time. You know what I mean?
Or, like, that makes sense, yeah.
Like, George and I spend a lot of money for that booth each year, and we want to make sure that, like, people come to the booth and
totally
enjoy
sense.
It, and that it's exciting and stuff like that. So, I'm sorry, Rob.
No, good. So you're doing my... you did your research.
A little bit of research. But when you're at Princeton and you're thinking about that stuff, what was your first draw to writing? Was it narrative fiction, or was it to do something like this where you're doing commentary on the world?
You know, that's what I was saying. Like, this is what I was saying. I wasn't political in terms of what I thought I was doing with writing. I was interested in political causes. I was involved in, like, environmentalism and stuff like that. And that sort of stuff. But there was sort of separate. It was like a separate compartment. So, so I was doing, like, I was writing sketches for, like, the school, like, musical theater troupe. I was in an improv group, as you said. I was also writing and, like, then the editor of the school humor magazine. So really more short form, less topical stuff, maybe pop culture-y stuff, but not, like, political topical stuff. And the narrative thing was that when I started, you know, I was getting towards the end of college, I started looking at a career, and I was, like, looking at TV. So I started writing what they call spec scripts, like sample episode scripts of shows that exist, where you write something in that world with those characters and in that voice and that style, but it's like you come up with the story yourself, and it's kind of like a sample that a lot of writers use as sort of their portfolio in Hollywood. So I started writing like half-hour scripts.
What were your shows that you were like?
Well, ironically, this is how old I am. It was the original Murphy Brown was the one. That,
yeah.
My writing partner at night and I wrote a really really terrible first outing of that, and then. News Radio, if anybody rembers that show, which is a really
Dave Foley, fantastic
show.
Was Dave Foley on that show?
Yeah,
Kids in the Hall?
He's one of the stars.
Yeah.
One of the stars of it. And then Phil Hartman, late Phil Hartman was on that. That was a great show. And then Frasier, and then I don't even remember. I mean, I wrote a bunch of them with this partner. And then I was also starting to work on screenplays and that sort of stuff as well. So that's the longer thing. I wasn't really, as I say, I wasn't really looking at topical late night stuff. But then my friend ended up sort of by happenstance with a job on that Dennis Miller show. And he's like, we might be looking for people. And I was like, oh, well, Dennis Miller, just to give it things in context for your possibly young audience, he used to be a pretty libertarian centrist guy.
Yeah.
And he has a fantastic album, which still holds up, called the Off-White album, which is his stand-up album, which I think he did after he was on SNL Weekend Update. I mean, imagine, he used to host Weekend Update, so how far right-wing could he have been
at that point,
right?
And I think for a lot of people, he was the Weekend Update person right before... oh God, I'm blanking.
Was he before Norm or before?
Before Norm.
Yeah.
I thought he was before Norm.
Yeah, it's hard to remember which was which.
But
it's like remembering all the Russian stars.
But he was really great at Weekend Update.
Oh, he had a really like special. His voice was so distinctive; it fit right, I think, with it.
I don't know. I don't remember him.
He and Norm
like
really made it their own. He and Chevy Chase and Norm, I think, more than anybody made it. And you know, I think Tina Fey, I think, made it their own show, their own vehicle.
I don't remember anybody else.
Yeah.
Like Norm, you can see him in other sketches on SNL. I don't think Dennis Miller was on any.
He doesn't really.
Yeah,
act
Dennis Miller wasn't really
other than
any.
I think Murder 1600, I think he doesn't look.
Was it, yeah, and then he was in...
And then one of the vampires.
One of the Bordello of Blood.
Oh, Bordello of Blood. Bordello of Blood, right.
He was in Bordello of Blood. The Tales of the Crypt movie.
Yeah.
Bordello of Blood.
Right. He's like...
That was Dennis Miller.
Freeze, you punk-ass vampires, cha-cha, or something.
So you show up, and you're a writer's assistant on the show.
Yeah, I'm a writer's assistant on that show.
Were you pumped? Were you like, this is the dude from Bordello of Blood?
As a
Bordello of Blood fan.
No, because he's a fantastic stand-up who had this really unique voice that nobody else had. Like, and his use of language, the complexity of his syntax was unlike what anybody was doing in stand-up, and I think still has done to some extent. And his reference pool, I mean, you got to geek out on, like, this is before Wikipedia and before you could just look things up. I think nowadays you would have to have, like, a Shazam app just to follow what he's saying now.
Sure.
But it was a great, like, he was, like, introducing Easter eggs in a way, sort of, like, that... You had to like search out what he was looking up, old classic movies or political references to know what he's talking about. And that was fun. The really fun part when I worked there was that he can't think of all those references himself. So he has a writing staff who would come up with stuff.
Yeah. And they're all guys your age and younger dudes and stuff.
Yeah. Men and women who are like our age who are like into deep cuts. And so we would just put a reference in when we turned in the writing to him, and he would just go through and read it. And he would just, instead of asking what it was or whatever, he would just say, "Is that a thing?" He said, "Yeah," and he goes, "Cool, it's in." He just trusted us.
That's great.
I know. He trusted the obscurity.
So you guys were able to just run with it and make the show.
Yeah, we could have just made things up completely.
That's awesome. And I think what I'm getting to now, because you've got this comic book, the graphic novel Shrinkage.
Finally, the plug.
No. Listen.
I'm kidding. This is.
I got to vet you. For the audience.
You are always doing due diligence.
Yeah.
I like it.
The audience needs to
on
be
camera,
vetted.
Off camera.
It's like, why am I going to buy this guy's comic book? Right. Oh, now you know why Geekscape is.
Jonathan is laying the foundation.
Well, if I come out and I'm like, hey, here's this book, you should get it.
You're like, great.
They're like,
never heard that before.
I don't know this effing guy.
Right.
They don't know you. They're not invested.
You're saying I'm not an established comics persona, and so in some way you have to introduce your comics audience to me? I don't know what you're talking about.
So I'm sitting here with
this interview is over. Sir.
So this is Chris Claremont's new book.
Right. Is it Clarimont?
So talk about Shrinkage, which you were signing at the Geekscape booth this summer. And then you are on a panel this coming weekend at LA Comic Con.
Yeah.
On Sunday at noon.
Yes.
Right before our zombie panel.
Okay. Yeah,
which is fine.
So people can do the whole, they can get the Cutner London Pass, they call it.
We can go
from one to the other.
If you're here on Sunday.
There's an escort who comes with white clothes service and brings you to the next panel.
Yeah, you can go from the... you guys are in like a transmedia panel with someone like Adam Glass.
Yes.
Who I'm friends with on Facebook, who works in comics. He writes, I think, Teen Titans right now, but he also goes on and he is working on TV. He's a TV guy.
Yeah, the whole panel is people who've crossed over from some other field and write or written comics. Mm-hmm. So Adam Glass, who wrote for Supernatural and Criminal Minds and stuff like that, and then Lisa Klink, who's written for a bunch of the Star Trek shows like Voyager and DS9, and then you've got Zoe Quinn, who I was kind of I was like, oh well, that's maybe that'll be a well attended panel.
That's really funny
for good or for ill.
Yeah.
I'm planning to do a lot of mansplaining to her, so I hope.
Oh no, you jerk. No, she's the whole Gamergate thing.
Yeah going on. she was the target of Gamergate, unfortunately. So
what did she do? No offense, Zoe, she's not gonna listen. What did she do before Gamergate? She's
a video game designer.
Designed
this like depression game on Twine, and then this was just her boyfriend, her ex did this to her, like got her, like was it sort of attacking her online? I forget how it started exactly, and that's what. And then other people, I think, followed suit or something. Or
I remember when it was happening, and our Geekscape Games podcast was talking a lot about it, and it lingered for a while and really became a thing, and in a lot of ways was like a precursor to this Me Too movement.
Yeah.
You know, because it's bullshit to treat somebody like that, you know, online, period, at the time. It's still bullshit. It's always going to be bullshit. But she really fell out of, I thought, the public persona, and now she's working in comics.
Yeah, she's doing something with Vertigo, I think.
Cool.
I imagine she was continuing to do games, but you know, after that, just that.
I'm sure it wasn't that great of an atmosphere for her.
Probably, yeah, exactly. It's not going out in public, maybe so much.
Fuck you guys! How can I tell my stories with less people involved who might be able to who might want to?
Why we do gaming in the first place? We don't want to deal with.
We got into gaming out of isolation, and now we have to make games. You have to deal with people who might put a knife in your back.
I know.
That's terrible.
You're doing gaming wrong, people.
But with this comic, How long did this idea gestate? Because you put out books. You had a book in the early 2000s. You put out a digital single, which is kind of like weird, right? But like you just
For
wrote
Kindle,
it.
Yeah. So yeah. So
it's kind of cool that Kindle can do that.
So you know, like to tag back to what you were saying originally. So I've been writing topical humor for over 10
topical
years.
Humor. That's the term.
Yeah, like an ointment, topical humor that you put on, but. After you go swimming, you have to have more of it. That works.
So I'm ready for that humor. I just did some laps. I'm ready for some more humor in my life. So
topical humor, the problem is that it's so current and of the moment that when the moment's over,
it's not evergreen
at
all.
It just disappears into the...
Do you feel like your book that you wrote during the Bush presidency about surviving the apocalypse?
Yeah.
Do you feel like that's not currently? I mean, it's more.
It was sort of ahead of its time in a way.
I mean, I remember we all thought we were gonna fucking die after nine. I mean, you lived in New York during 9/11.
No, I was in L.A. But
you were in L.A.
Yeah, yeah.
During 2001,
I just moved in 2002, like a year after it, because I was like, that place looks like things are happening there.
Oh, you just moved to New York?
Yeah, I was in L.A. in 2001.
Right.
Dennis Miller was in L.A. And ironically, I had just literally gotten my first break that I was going to be... Well, I just gotten news that I was going to be a writer on the Dennis Miller Show. This was my first big writing break right before, like a month before 9/11. So I was like, yes, this is amazing.
And so now you're in L.A.
I was still in L.A. My first writing job was on Dennis Miller. Yeah. And it was. I found out I was going to get that job a month before 9/11. And I was like, yes, the stars have aligned. History is moving in the right direction
now. Oh, my
now.
God.
And
then, I had moved to...
Record scratch.
I had moved to New York a week earlier before 9/11.
A week? Wow.
A week before 9/11. And so, that being said, I think that we all felt like we were going to die.
Right.
That like...
Especially if you live there. Yeah. I mean, across the country, you sort of...
The Bush
bit.
Administration didn't help our feelings at all. They were like, no, you are all going to die.
Right.
Only we can protect you. You have to buy all this shit. And we have to put up these...
Stop asking questions and go shopping.
Trust in Diebold. Right. And so, here we are... and I want to see that Dick Cheney movie really damn bad because they ran us up a damn flagpole too. So you write this book about the apocalypse and how to survive it or at least be comfortable during it.
I wrote the only feel-good guide to the apocalypse.
Feel good
it's going to be better. And in a way it was coming out of the Daily Show voice then, because our response to like all the sort of terror and shock and numbness and stuff we were feeling from them was to sort of like put a fake brave face on it, like a really huge grin.
Yeah.
You imagine like sort of like someone like Rob Corddry or that like making a huge grin when everything's going to shit, like sort of thing. That was the sort of style. It was like ironically point out the good things, good parts of things. And so that's what I did with this book, was I made this whole guide to all the different kinds of apocalypses. I did so much fun research. Like I watched all the Mad Max stuff again and watched all these like
zombie movies.
All these
and
zombie
stuff.
Movies. I got to just, I'm telling my wife, I'm like, it's research.
Yeah, it's research. I get to hang out.
Right.
Careful. That's how I ended up drinking my recycled urine in Dark of the Dead. So we did a zombie documentary.
I think I won in this particular case. That's awesome.
Everybody was trying to sell me on these water filters, and I kept being like, can you pee in it? And they're like, yeah, have you done it? No. After five or six guys trying to sell me water filters, I was finally like, here we go. Let's try it.
So you were also preparing for Waterworld.
I think that right now we're in this cultural, this like shared social miasma, right, that's being put upon us by just this onslaught of news, right?
Yeah.
I think that post 9/11, we were all doing that, and it led directly into the zombie obsession because we all wanted to deal with some level of our mortality and our shared mortality on a global scale. Because we're being barraged now with doublespeak. We were being barraged then with images of our own demise, whether it be Katrina or tsunamis or 9/11 or war in the Middle East. We had to start thinking about our own mortality. We didn't want to directly address it. So we were like, oh, fictitious monster that represents everyone's death. Like,
it keeps coming and can't,
let's
can't
do this.
Be stopped ever.
Yeah, great. Like, let's deal with death as a metaphor.
Right.
And so I think that directly led to the zombie thing now. But then now the zombie thing's dying off and being replaced by the other shared social miasma of trust and patriotism, and you start to see shows like The Romanovs now starting to be popular, or shows about conspiracy theory being really popular in television and narrative and stuff like that. And especially with like the binge viewing stuff right now, you see shows on Netflix and Hulu and Amazon and stuff like that dealing with these really deep dives into conspiracy, you know. And it started with House of Cards, and now it's gone into Man on the High Castle and I'm blanking on the one where they the women all have to wear the
Handmaid's Tale,
the Handmaid's Tale, and stuff like that. I think it's all part of the same trigger.
We have to push the darkness somewhere else, and then it comes back at us, like in terms of our pop culture.
It's all the threat of apocalypse.
Right.
So you were your finger was on the pulse then, and now it's just another sad pulse.
I know.
It's a different pulse.
A different kind of pulse than we could have imagined.
But you wrote that as what was your impetus for writing that?
I don't think that I was so much that I actually felt literally like I feel much more worried about the world just being destroyed now than I did then. I think.
Sure.
I just sort of like my own world. I think that was just sort of like. In a way, I thought of an apocalypse as the ultimate form of escapism.
It's party time.
Maybe it was just living
like
in New York.
The Purge.
Yeah, exactly. Like the Purge. It's like living in New York, and you're just surrounded by people all the time, and all the sort of BS of the day-to-day stuff, and then just, in a way, it's like a claustrophobic response. Like, what if, fuck it, I'm just going to blow everything up and clear the landscape. And start over with like new rules and that sort of things.
I think there are absolutely people on the internet who want to do that.
Yes.
There may be people in our own offices who want to do that in our, right. in our
when you drive in LA traffic for like 15 minutes, you feel like doing that.
I think that there are people who like when I talk to people about something like getting involved in voting, and they're like, "What's the fucking point?"
Yeah.
And how many people do you see online or as fans or as elected officials who are just like, "What's the fucking point?"
Right.
What's the fucking point? Right. Let's grab everything we can for ourselves and let's fucking go.
Yeah.
You know, I think that there's a level of apocalyptic mindset going on all the way up the chain.
All these billionaires have these like secret homes in New Zealand that they're going to
escape
to.
Sure. I interviewed a dude for that zombie documentary who was building bug out shelters.
Mm-hmm.
What a dumb fuck. I'm going to say that to you right now, Rob. This guy is in Los Angeles selling people underground shelters.
Mm-hmm.
And they're out in the desert, and I said, "Where's your bug out shelter? You know, and it's got all the amenities to last you for the next 20 plus years
until
the radiation washes away, which it doesn't. Just ask people in Chernobyl. But it's got all the amenities to be able to survive for years underground. And he's in Los Angeles, bragging to me about how he's got this shelter, how he sells a ton of these shelters, and he's got his.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well. Knowing the real estate prices, it's probably not here in Los Angeles, is it? He goes, well, I ain't going to tell you where it is. It was probably out in the desert, middle of nowhere somewhere, right? He goes, yeah. I was like, so when shit hits the fan, you got to get out to the desert, right? And he's mm-hmm. like, yeah. Have you ever been in 5 o'clock traffic in Los Angeles, pal? Yeah. I was like, you're fucked.
You ever tried going to Palm Springs?
You're never getting to your bug out shelter.
Right.
Like, you will be food by the time you get to freaking Riverside.
Your one safety plan is, I'm going to walk to the desert.
Yeah.
There's like, my...
Through a post-apocalyptic wasteland. Of people trying to fight for gas and water and food. Guess what? You just became lunch for somebody, you moron.
I know.
He was so proud of himself for having this bug out shelter in the middle of fucking nowhere. I was like, unless we're conducting this interview in it, your plan is fucking stupid.
Right. Assuming no one finds it. I like the tradition that you trash previous guests on the podcast.
No, he wasn't a guest on the podcast. He was a guy in our movie who was.
Oh, okay.
And he was just like, he was mean. I was like, you are not.
That's why he'll be living alone in the desert.
You are mean. No, former guest of the podcast, if there are people, I don't have you on the podcast if I don't want to talk to you. Does that make sense?
Well, I thought maybe you'd soured.
No. If anything, I've gotten more hopeful.
Oh, wow. That's sweet. That's sweet. The journey continues.
How was writing this comic different than writing... I'll just go the long way to get to my question. How is writing the comic a different itch being scratched for you than things that you had left over, perhaps, or had explored not far enough in your previous writing outside of topical writing?
Well, one thing is, from a professional point of view as opposed to a creative point of view, you know, it's really hard to get things made and sold in Hollywood, obviously.
Sure.
I mean, even if you're, like, successful at it, getting the thing onto the screen, big or small, is like itself such a like almost like winning the lottery sort of thing. And it's so hard to get something made that's not just a script on paper that's going to sit in someone's desk if you're lucky, if you can even get it to a person. So for me, I've always loved comics, not because I'm like crazy into like superheroes and that sort of and the mythologies and stuff. I'm not really into that stuff so much, but I love the form, the storytelling format that you have sort of like a movie in your hands that has like all the visuals, or at least maybe even the best of the visuals, and they can be anything you want because you don't have to worry about a budget.
What were some of the ones that you grew up with that influenced you the most?
Comics?
Yeah.
I think...
And this isn't like vetting you.
No, this isn't a cred test. This is the one. This is like
Geekscape is we're fall. A half hour more into the podcast.
Why do you have electrical prods attached to my wrist right now when I'm answering
If you
this?
Do not say these
You are the weakest link! Why am I sitting on an ejector seat? This is not going to shock anybody else, but I think I was kind of caught up in the sort of nouveau graphic novel wave of like those ushered in by like Watchmen and Dark Knight Returns.
So, 1986, yeah.
Yeah, I mean that's I don't know if I discovered them then, but it was, you know, at some point in their heyday, let's say in the 80s, at some point. And I used to sort of browse at comic book stores, and then I heard about those, and I started picking up, and they were just so different. I mean, I collected sort of an average mediocre swath of whatever was on the
spinner rack.
What?
Remember the spinner rack?
The spinner rack. Yeah, yes, the spinner rack. Right, yeah. Right, exactly. Although I did end up with I've been going through my collection recently, and like I got the original like Wolverine that came out, and like the original Punisher series and stuff like that. So
that's Chris Claremont, that original
whoever that is.
The original he wrote that Wolverine you just referenced.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And then there was a Punisher miniseries before there was an original series.
Yeah.
And it was so popular, I think they added a fifth issue to it before it was even finished. So my titles they both. So I picked up stuff like that, but a lot of it was like for some reason I was like super deep into the whole Superman world around him. Like I have World of Krypton, I have World of Metropolis, I had all these things I bought about. And I was like, who knew I was so into like Superman's like ancillary side stories and stuff like that.
A bunch of kids on like the CW.
I think I have like Crypto the Superdog number one or something like that. Like I was like
not a bad issue to have, I'm
right,
sure.
It turns out. Like, yeah. But I was like I didn't even remember that I was into that stuff. Which, you know, maybe it was a little more forgettable. But like those dark, like grounded personal ones like really kind of grabbed me, and that kind of actually that kind of got me, I think, into the X-Men, which is more sort of personal, more part of personal, like, you know, conflicts and, you know, baggage and stuff people are dealing with. I got into those kind of things more so than the Superman stuff after that.
Yeah. I mean, funny enough, I kept joking about Chris Claremont. He is the guy who, with John Byrne, wrote a lot of that run in X-Men. And then, of course, John Byrne revamped Superman post Crisis and gave him the mullet.
Right.
The super mullet. And I guess, you're in high school at that time.
Yeah.
When all that stuff is going down.
Mullets?
Mullets for sure. But you're like finishing high school and you're getting ready to go to school. And that stuff is really influential. I think that when you start getting into comics, you're going to buy like Crypto the Superdog and stuff that is fun because that's that's just your perception of comics. And then as you dig deeper, you start to find those albums, right? Like think about like music when you're like, oh yeah, I started listening to music because it's on the radio.
Right.
But then I went to the store to buy the album and I started finding all this stuff. And you got that weird guy who's like, hey man, you listen to this in comic stores. And why I think comic stores feed this lifeblood and are so important to this culture is like gaming stores, and why I think Amazon can never really win is you don't have that guy, that weird guy who's
you need a spirit guide, like a spirit animal.
Have you tried this?
Right.
Hey, there's this your dealer. You know what I mean? Someone suggests stuff in that whole culture. So those are your comics, and you look up now, and you're right. The cutthroat nature of Hollywood has led you to want to tell this story. But the avenues being pretty limited, especially like having read big chunks of your book, like the budgetary concerns.
Yeah.
Here you are, and you've got a chance to do it.
Mm-hmm.
How do you start putting it together? Do you have experience in comics?
It was a long and multi-stepped process. But basically, what happened was, I remember I just wanted to make a comic for a long time because I just, as I said, I like the way it tells a story, and I'd always been a huge fan of the human brain. I always read like brain research, and I would like read books about the brain and the mind and stuff that's gonna come out. And I was like, I'm a fan of like trying to take what you're super interested in and like do your work in that space.
Okay.
So I was like, I wanted to think of some story that had to do with like the human brain. And then I started thinking of like a Fantastic Voyage thing where like people got shrunk down and were inside someone's brain. And then I was like, because they were aliens.
They're coming to get you, by the way. Sorry, Geekscapes, we are recording this outside.
We're being arrested right now.
he said a couple things that
freeze geeks.
You guys were talking about the apocalypse.
Put those inhalers where I can see them.
Say hello to the apocalypse in there.
You guys talking John Byrne? I like his Hellboy stuff better. What? Oh, that's it. It's amazing that a copter.
So you've got this.
So I wanted to. I imagine alien. Like, why would we be in the vein? Why would we be in the brain? Like, what if tiny aliens were taking over
like
someone's
inner
brain?
Space.
Yeah, like inner space. But why are like why is that even happening? And then
they're hijacking you too.
They're hijacking.
They're running you like a rental car.
Right. They're puppet masters.
Right.
And I was like, that's not going to ever be a movie because it's. I mean, it could be, but it's just like a huge budget movie, and it could be really cheesy. Like Fantastic Voyage, frankly, looks super cheesy, and I think even nowadays. It's just expensive and complicated. So, but I thought this would be like a great match for a comic book because you could just do all the visuals you wanted, you know, in the brain, and you could tell a whole story. I floated around to some people. I tried approaching the majors, and you know, as you have pointed out, I'm not really anybody in that world, and so I didn't get very far with that. And then. And then I thought maybe I'll go out on spec and do this. And so I was looking for, like, I thought, I'm not legit, but if I get a legit artist, and they'll illustrate some of it. So here's what I'm thinking, knowing so much about the comic business. A hardworking, legit comic book artist is going to, A, do something for free for some guy he doesn't know, and B, is going to do it just, like, on a chance that someone wants, and C, has time for me.
Yeah.
Because all these things I don't know, so I don't get anywhere with any artists.
And if you go the crowdfunding route, then you've just added a second 40-hour-a-week job to your...
Right.
So, did you ever think about the idea?
I thought about it, but that's actually. You're skipping the story a little bit because that actually was a version of what happened. So then I crossed paths with this group called Farrago Comics, which is a startup that was based in Atlanta through friends of my parents, actually. So it all goes back to the hometown in the end. And they're saying, we want to be the Spotify of comics. Like, we want to do what Comixology does, but for free. Like, we.
Okay.
Basically, they made relationships with. Golden Age and IDW and some other places, and they said we can get their backlists of stuff they're not selling anyway, you know, in comic book stores, put them online digitally, and then make a service where you don't have to pay a subscription fee, you don't have to buy them, but we sell ads. So when you watch a comic book, there's an ad at the beginning, but it's like a, you know, it's a
that's a tough game though.
It's hard. It's really hard.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a pretty good idea in theory.
It's a good idea in theory, and I don't know how Spotify went and ran away with it.
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe you guys are listening to this on Spotify right now, but I don't know how they
make money off it. Right?
Well, how they hit that critical mass.
Critical mass is
to like make sure that those ads were worth anything.
Right, and like how do you? I don't know how you measure it. I mean, you can measure it stuff, but how do you know if it becomes worthwhile to the advertiser? So, it was around for a couple of years, and then they said we wanted to make an original series, like, you know, House of Cards was for Netflix. We wanted to make something that'll get us on the map, and I said, actually, I have this idea. I haven't been able to sell anywhere, but I think, like, you know. Someone who's really willing to take a chance on some kind of out there idea, and they liked the idea, and then they launched a crowdfunding site for us, and they found John Lucas for me, who
much better than you doing all
much
that.
Better than I was doing.
I mean, not that you were doing, but much better than you were capable of. Like,
yeah,
like,
I didn't really.
No
even,
offense to you, it's just
I didn't
like,
even know him. I mean, that's how like unconnected I was.
John Lucas.
Yeah.
But former coach and player of the San Antonio Spurs.
Yeah, yeah, right. It's amazing. He's a real crossover.
John
artist.
Lucas is now, I think he's currently a coach on the Warriors or the Rockets, one of those two teams. But he's one of the famous players of like the 70s who like cocaine was a big deal. You know what I mean?
Right.
And he was like one of the famous warning like examples for players like, hey man, don't it. Like, because.
Isn't that great that that's his legacy?
Like, I remember him as being a kid, from being a kid and going to see the Spurs.
That
play.
Guy has so much energy. It's like he never sleeps.
Like, he was a great coach, and I guess he still is, but when I was looking at your comic, I was like, that's really funny that he shares a name with John Lucas. You know, and that's the hilarious. Art. And John
what
Lucas,
if he had a third act in his life and that's just what he did now?
That would be amazing because, you know, he has worked for the majors. Like, John Lucas, like the artwork that you have is from somebody who's worked on Marvel's books and things like that. So did he inform a lot of the visuals, or did you have an idea on it from...
To some extent. I mean...
Because I'm always fascinated by that little game.
I think we were kind of a mind meld, which was great.
A mind meld, yeah.
Yeah, because they brought me a lot of... Farrago brought me a couple of different artists, and I would look at them and say, I can imagine this person doing it this way or something. When I saw his work, I was like, this is exactly sort of who I am creatively already.
They'll hit all the points. They'll hit every... Yeah, they'll be
yeah,
able to
we're
do
just on the same page because he has, like, that sweet spot between realistic and grotesque, which is kind of where I am, too, where they're kind of, like, a little bit larger than life, but they're still sort of realistic, and they live in a realistic world, but, like... They are like outsized emotions are sort of reflected in their faces and their mm-hmm. heads and their gestures and stuff like that sure. in a way that I enjoy. So I don't think he really actually did. I mean, I love to collaborate with people, and with all, it was really more like that I would write stuff and then he would just do it back, and I would, either it was like I saw it or it was better. And I mean, I would say that like when you develop characters, you have to like dig deep into them to give the artist something to go on. So working with him and like going back and forth and getting the character sketches in place when we did the crowdfunding round so we could show people the characters, that really helped me, because he would ask a lot of detailed questions, and that when you ask about someone's details, that helps you learn about the person's like, so.
No, it's, I mean, clearly I love asking questions. I'm just fascinated by the process. Having written comics, I found the creative aspects of it incredibly rewarding. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no limitations on things like budget. There's no limitations on things like how far you can push a sequence. The rhythm of it, how did you find the rhythm of writing comics? That was what I found troubling, is that as a filmmaker, it's like you're writing and shot listing and store and floor plan, like doing all the visual work at the same time that you're doing the thing, and then you like give it to your DP and is hope yeah. that they give
you have
back
to do it all. You have to be the DP yourself in a way.
Like, in a sense, you have to go and do a lot of that stuff and then send it back. I remember posing and taking photos of myself to an artist and be like, no, like this is how they're standing, and like take yeah. a photo of myself, and I'm like, this is fucking silly, but.
You have to think about so many visual things that you don't think about when you're writing for someone else, as you said, to figure it out.
So the flow in it, when you're used to just writing narrative, like the flow of it felt choppy.
Did you find that? It was really interesting. Like, well, one thing is that I actually, I was a huge fan of Posehn and Duggan's run on Deadpool.
Which it's fantastic.
Which Lucas had actually drawn for, and I didn't realize that I'd already seen his work before.
Jerry's somebody who I will not talk trash on. He's a former guest.
Yes, Gary's the best. Jerry's the best.
He's in fantastic.
He's great. So, and Posehn was on the Conan show, mm-hmm. and I also really liked their book, The Last Christmas, if you know that
yeah,
one.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I thought was just really outstanding. I tried to sort of meet him over the years, because I like his comedy, I like his comics and stuff like that. And I don't remember how I finagled. I think I met his manager. So I finagled, and I went in and told him that I was working in the comic book with John, and that Jerry had been inspiring and stuff like that and all that. And he was really nice. And he was like, this is funny, because I think they were still in the middle of the run, and Posehn would just put his head in his hands. Do you think this guy who's already a star in a comic and is going to write like a cool-ass comic book mm-hmm. would be like excited about it? And he just puts his head in his hands. He goes, that's so fucking tiring. I was like, why? And he said, yeah. he said, you have to get something on the end of each page at the very end that makes them want to turn the page. Mm-hmm. And I thought about that, like, you know, you think about in TV, like there's a cliffhanger you have to do at the end of the act break before you go to commercial. In a sitcom, that's how you structure like the first half and the second half, or the three thirds. In a drama, you have to do five of them because there's like five commercial breaks.
Sure.
Definitely interested in thinking about things in those terms. I'm used to that. But the idea that you have to kind of like come up with like little mini cliffhangers or
every five or six panels.
Yeah, every five or six. And also then I had Peter David's great book on comic writing mm-hmm. inspiring me, and he's like, don't do more than six panels a page. He has like a sure. word count, a bubble count, which was, all these structures were really helpful to me, because it was like, this is the scaffolding you have to climb out on.
And you hadn't been reading comics, like,
I mean, I had, yeah, but I hadn't,
but not like voraciously,
like a scientist, yeah. like an architect, like, you know, you have to have some kind of like architecture to walk out
absolutely
over like the depths of like for you know, like a tightrope walker, you want to have a net of some sort. So I was using all these things as guidelines, and then when Posehn said that, I was like, oh, that sounds hard, but that actually kind of like helped me focus the story, because I was like, I knew that every sixth panel a big enough thing had or a question or a this, now this is going to happen thing had to be happening. And so if I was writing towards that, I sort of would reverse engineer what happened in each page. And then just to answer your question about yeah. choppiness, you have to break time up into like basically five units, like five strobe light flashes of like, you see this, you mm-hmm. see this, you see this, or this has jumped to this, but like you only get 5 moments to work with. And like looking about time like that was really interesting for me.
In having read the book, in portions of the book, Geekscape is, I'm not going to lie, like I bust, this weekend was insane. But... and then coming up later this week, we have our whole Daredevil special, because Netflix's Daredevil, Ian Kerner, is yelling at me all weekend because I haven't watched Daredevil. Like,
just sit down and watch all
of it. I'm going to sit down and watch all 13 episodes straight. No offense, Geekscape, it's not that I wouldn't do it for you, but that special is going to come in a few days if you guys are waiting to find out what I thought of Daredevil, which I hope not too many. I mean, maybe you are, because you're listening to this podcast, but it's a busy weekend, but having read the portions of the book that I've read, like, I see that strict structure in there, and it's not unlike writing a joke where, like, every third line has to be the punchline. Every third, right. You know, it's got a rhythm to it. And I can see how mathematically that led you to, I mean, every page of this book feels like a short, little short.
Well, that's the idea, is that it has to sort of, like, you have to start.
I mean, it changes somewhere. Location.
Right.
Like, not just.
I would look at, I break things up by pages, because I know that, especially with digital, which some people were going to be reading it, this was going to be meant for digital. So with digital, because of the swiping thing, you literally just see, I think most of the time you see it one page at a time as opposed to handheld paper comics. You can kind of get the whole sweep of it and sort of see where it's going over two pages. You just literally have the viewer for one page. And not only that, they're going to be on a device, which means that they could also be checking Facebook or their email or their text and say, you've got to hold on to them for that page so they want to read the next one.
The distraction algorithm.
When someone picks up a comic book, they're going to read the comic book. It's not that long and they're into it and that's all they're holding. You know, when they're on a device, I think you have to, like, shine a spotlight and just, like, hold them a little bit more.
It's just almost lethal for any medium to keep you for over 3 minutes on those things.
Right.
I mean,
right.
3 minutes is a long time on a device.
God forbid someone's reading it on their phone and the print is tiny, too.
Oh, it freaks me out. Yeah. It totally freaks me. As a storyteller, it just freaks me out to be like, hey, man, good luck.
Yeah.
The digital thing is tough, and then you've got I try and turn off notifications for everything.
Right.
If I want it, I will go to it.
Yeah.
Because
it's hard, man.
But
then it's internalized at this point. We've got our clocks telling us, hey, you should check on your Facebook and check your...
Nothing on Facebook? Go to your Instagram. Nothing on Instagram? Yes. Go to your Twitter.
Come on, board hamster. She got some more sugar water.
And you're in this wheel just getting stuck.
Yeah. I leave pellets everywhere.
You do.
Have I gone too far with the metaphor?
I leave pellets and keep cardboard away from me.
Right. I do love habit trails, though.
So this weekend, you've got your panel at noon on Sunday.
Yeah.
You guys have a pretty good lineup, and I'm pretty excited to go and check it out.
So it's all people who've crossed over, who've crossed over from other fields. Or I think one guy, like Aaron Stout, I think has gone from illustrating to writing or something like that.
Oh,
like
cool.
He's within comics. But it's people who've, like, switched into writing comics who weren't doing them before and were doing something else, so...
That'll be fun.
That'll be interesting to hear about from the people.
And that's at 1 o'clock on Sunday, Geekscape. That's at noon on Sunday. That is not at 1 o'clock on Sunday. That is at noon on Sunday. So one thing about LA Comic Con, I want to warn some of you Geekscapers who are coming in for the weekend or live here in LA and are planning on checking out LA Comic Con, is it does get swarmed on Saturday and Sunday. So if you have a weekend pass, come on Friday, pick up your badge early so you can walk right in on Saturday and Sunday, because Saturday and Sunday, those mornings for some reason turn into Dawn of the Dead.
that's a good lead-in for yours.
Yeah, and so Geekscape is like, definitely get there early to get your badge a few hours early, and then
are these fast fans or slow fans?
Yeah, death is supposed to be an impediment, not a freaking energy drink. So we only do slow zombies.
Fair enough.
Here, not immediate death,
but mentally slow. Not, you know, they walk really fast, but like,
I think the Geekscapists. I think the Geekscapists are super fast. If you found this podcast, it means that you've got some great taste. If you've listened this far into the show, it means you've got fantastic taste. And if you've been with us for as long as we've been around, you are a credit to society. I will not besmirch the Geekscapists, except maybe Big Yanks. Love you, Big Yanks. So I would say get there early. The panel is at noon on Sunday,
and we're gonna have a sort of impromptu signing.
Oh, cool!
I'm gonna bring some copies, and I'll sign it for you right after. Yeah. Like in the same.
Bring your iPads, and he will sign your. I'm kidding.
Yeah. I have physical copies. It's amazing.
That's what he was doing at the Geekscape booth this summer. Geekscapists. In general, LA Comic Con, there's a lot of stuff going on. You guys can find everything that's happening at LA Comic Con on FanGuru. That's a podcast app. We've promoted the podcast app before. Well, it's not a podcast app. It's a convention app. It's on your phones. The cool thing about FanGuru is, you remember we had Keith Trailins on the show about a year ago promoting LA Comic Con. He used to help run LA Comic Con. He now works at FanGuru. So they were here at E3. At E3, we promoted the whole obstacle course. Not obstacle course. It was like a scavenger hunt. I went and did the scavenger hunt for FanGuru. It was fun. I got some free stuff. And they're going to be back at the convention because they're big promoters of the convention, and they're actually the official convention app. So if you guys are going to the convention and want to find out what's going on, and you want to make a plan, like you can save your own schedule, you can browse the schedule and highlight things and put them in your own, make your own schedule out of that, download the Fanguru app. It kind of saved my ass because I'm on a panel at noon on Saturday. We've got our Kaiju versus Giant Robots panel that I'm moderating with some pretty amazing people, some ex-Power Rangers who, like, obviously have fought
Kaiju. It's like Pacific Rim, but talking.
Yeah, it's like some Pacific Rim stuff going on. I've got FJ DeSanto, one of the Transformers writers. I've got lots of cool people on that panel. That's at noon on Saturday. At 4 o'clock, we are doing a Monster Squad panel, a bit of a reunion, and we're looking at the documentary that Andre Gower, the lead of Monster Squad, put together and is about to release, called Wolfman's Got Nards. And our own Matt Kelly is in the documentary. You know Matt Kelly.
Yeah.
And he's the host of the Horror Movie Night podcast on Geekscape. So he's in the documentary, and we're going to be talking about the documentary at 4 o'clock on Saturday. If you want to skip that, I would guess it's because you're going to go watch the FP sequel, FP2, Beats of Rage, at 3:30. Their own Jason Trost, and that's Saturday. I mean, Saturday's going to be pretty packed. Go to Fanguru, download that app, and get it, and kind of fix your schedule. And then Sunday, we've got Rob's panel at noon. So if you want to make the bounce into comics, or just, you know what, just make a life change. I'm sure this will be a metaphorical as hell, like, panel. These are people who are, like, creatively vibrant, and they're, like, trying to find all these different avenues to be creative. It's probably a great panel for you. And at 1, we'll be doing a zombie panel, because obviously zombies is something I like to talk about. We'll be doing a cool panel about zombies with former Geekscape guests Clark Wolf, John Schnitzer, Gavin Hignite, and a few other people. So it's a packed weekend, but put a big circle on noon on Sunday, especially if you want a signed copy.
That's a good time to be there.
Of Shrinkage. And the inspiration for Shrinkage was beyond your interest in just the brain.
Interest in the brain, and then this is actually cool. I just had this idea of just this happening in someone's head, like an average person, and I managed to get an email to Karen Berger, who was running Vertigo at the time, and she it wasn't really a Vertigo title. Again, sure. Like, I don't know, I was thinking, but I was like, why not? Vertigo is bad as hell. Why not try them?
You don't know what their edict is.
Their art is amazing. Why not? Like, you know. So I tried, and she actually wrote back, you know, after many months, because, you know, she thinks she's kind of busy, but she wrote back, and she's like, this is a really interesting idea, I like the visuals, but the stakes are not high enough for this to be a comic, like, it's just like in a guy's brain, and I started, so basically it was a pass, but it was a really helpful tidbit, and I thought, that's true, it could be higher, and I thought, what's the possible highest stakes brain you could think of, and it would be the President of the United States, basically.
And that's your opening.
You know, he's got the button next to him, and he's got so much thing, and
the atomic football.
Who knew that we would have an unstable hijacked brain president.
Yeah, that.
This is like in the early 2000s. This is during the Obama era. I was thinking of all this.
So you're writing this during the Obama era in the late 2000s. You know, 10 years ago, you're putting this book together, and
once again, had a
you're
time.
Like, and you believed in hope. Remember the Obama thing? It's like, oh, we're never going to go back to this Cro-Magnon fear monster.
No, I had a whole different graphic novel I never sold that was about this whole... It was kind of a Buffy thing that was like, there's a secret world hellmouth underneath Washington, D.C., and like all the demons and politicians were like, you know, like in business together, but we didn't know about it.
It was like They Live?
Yeah, kind of like that, but less sunglass-oriented, but it was more bifocal, really. So I had this whole idea, and I turned that in like right after Obama's first election in 2008. I sent that in to a bunch of people, including my book agent, and they're like, you know, people are really hopeful about politics right now, so I don't think cynicism about Washington would really sell.
Oh my God,
I was like, listen to me, I've been at The Daily Show for 8 years. This is going to change. People are going to be very angry and sad about politics very soon. Trust me.
Stupidity is cyclical. Right. Trust me.
People are not going to enjoy the inauguration moment for very long. But this is more of a backdoor into politics.
So after this podcast, Rob's going to go and brush the dust off of that one and resubmit it because it's insane.
Well, now politics has outstripped satire and comics to some extent. Like, it's so weird.
All of these late night shows are all political. They have all taken the page from The Daily Show and have become political commentary.
Everything. Yeah.
Like you can't avoid it. I don't think Jimmy Kimmel's even joking anymore.
He just shows videos and just reacts like a human being to it, right?
Yeah, he's just putting shit out, and everybody's just become a resistance fighter.
I know. Well, I mean, even the fact that it just sort of it just dwarfs everything. It's eclipses everything. Like during Comic-Con, during San Diego Comic-Con, that was when Trump was meeting with Putin in Helsinki.
Yeah.
And I tweeted out, I said, I can't believe I'm starting Comic-Con while our president is literally meeting with a Russian accented guy in a secret icy fortress.
Yeah. Yeah, no.
It's like, it just seems like coming out of a comic book.
Straight up supervillain shit. And I think Trey Parker and Matt Stone were like, how do we continue with South Park when this is going down? You know what I mean? It's really insane the times we're living through. And if you're still listening to this Geekscape, I would like to prompt all of you to vote November 6th and see if we can either bring about our quick demise or maybe maybe add 4 more years to the ticker.
That's your motivation.
That's your motivation.
Change the time frame of our demise.
Geekscape, let's definitely thank Rob for coming on the Geekscape show. You can find him on Twitter.
Yeah, at Apocalypse Howe.
Apocalypse How. You can also find the book. You have a website where you sell the book?
Is at robkuttner.com.
Okay, robkuttner.com.
You can order directly from there and check out some of my other videos and my other books that we mentioned, like the Apocalypse book and stuff.
Geekscapists, you have your homework cut out for you.
And also, it's the digital version is ironically on Comixology. The mothership did swallow up the... after the Eldron of my startup was destroyed, the Death Star continued. So if you want to try an issue digitally, it's hey, look, people are reading it.
People are reading it, I think that's the ultimate thing for a storyteller, is that eyeballs are sticking to our stories. Geekscapists, thank you guys for sticking with us this long. Tell your friends about Geekscape. If you're on one of these podcatchers that leaves a review, leave us a review and be like, hey, that Ray Romano guy talks too much. and for sure, subscribe, whether or not recommend whether or not you're listening to this thing on an iTunes or on a Google device or on Spotify, wherever you guys are getting it. Recommend it to your friends and keep it going, because we have our Daredevil special coming up. We've got LA Comic Con. All those panels that I'm on will end up on the feed, so we can bring you guys to LA Comic Con as well. And we're just gonna have a great time as we close out the year, our 13th year. I believe. Is it our 13th year, Geekscape? Wow. It will be the culmination of our 12th year. Holy crap.
That's amazing.
Yeah, we have not found anything else to do with our lives. We love you guys. Follow Rob online and go check out this book, Shrinkage. Okay, Geekscape? Over and out. Geekscape forever. Peace.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.